Hi, everybody. Welcome to Buzzing About Romance. I am Leah, and on this episode, I'm giving you a quick shot of romance author spotlight edition. And on this spotlight, I am welcoming author Alex Harrow. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Okay, Alex is a former academic, adjunct cashier, blueberry harvester, and Kentuckian. Alex E. Harrow is now a full-time writer living in Virginia with her husband and their semi-feral kids. So, first question, why a writer?
I feel like you probably get this answer a lot, but I think that anyone who is a writer is only there because they're actually really just a reader who is trying to make a job out of it. Like, I think if you read books intensely enough and you find yourself rereading them and rereading them and trying to kind of figure out how they work as art, like eventually you want to try it. So it's just a sort of extended hobby of reading.
Yeah. What made you push publish that first time?
Like seeking out actual publication rather than just keeping things in as Word documents. I mean, it's kind of funny. I would say that at the time I thought of it in fairly mercenary terms. Like me and my husband had lived around the poverty line, you know, dipping above and below it for most of our adult lives. And when I was first writing short stories, it seemed like a pretty amazing way to make $200 because there's actual professional markets for shorts, for genre fiction at least. And I think though that that was kind of a cover in some ways for what is really kind of an artistic ambition. Like I think when you're writing, you want to be read. You want like that's writing is only half of it, specifically to be consumed and received, and so I think that's why I sought out publishing.
So you said you're a reader. Is there a subgenre that you tend to read the most?
I started out big time in fantasy and sci-fi, mostly fantasy, like from my mom.
Okay.
So there's like not very many major sci-fi and fantasy writers of the 70s through 90s that we didn't hit together,
Okay.
especially women writers. And I've just like moved around since then. Like, I don't know. I like to think that I've hit most subgenres at this point. I need to hit spy thrillers. I haven't really done those at all. I want to see what's going on over there. They seem exciting. Right now, I'm very, very, very deep into historical romances. That's what I am always reading, like one or two of those a week, kind of in the background of my regular work reading.
Is there an author that you're really drawn to in those historicals?
I have a few. I have a few. I have recently, I don't think quite finished all of Laura Kinsale's.
Okay.
But they're on the extremely dramatic and angsty side. They're like 400 pages, like an unreasonable length for the genre. Absurd. Like there's one book where like Laura Kinsale, where I think it's in the same book that they get like shipwrecked in the Falkland Islands for like 6 months, and then they get like abducted by pirates later, and then there's a coup in another country. Like I like the absolute drama when it becomes almost like high fantasy. That's
Like
my favorite.
you like a bonkers book where you're like, there's no way all of this could happen to one couple.
Yeah, what are we doing in this genre if we're not going the full bonkers is what I want from my historical romance.
I mean, I can get on that page. I love a bonkers book. Like and the messier, the better.
Yeah, and I mean bonkers both in plot-wise, like, I have a lot of fun with that, but I also mean like an intensity of emotion that's not reason that I'm in historical romance than contemporary. I want a world where they can't go to therapy. They just have to work these feelings out through like insane declarations, betrayals. I want someone to like, you know, do just the most absurd things to each other.
A duel, perhaps.
Perhaps a duel for someone's honor? Is that too much to ask for?
Not at all. So, can you share any writing rituals or habits that you have that help you stay focused and productive?
No, but if you have any, I really need to be focused and productive right now. No, I tried for a long time to kind of stay away from ritual and from convincing myself that there are really specific things I need to write. And that's because I kind of became a published author simultaneously with having my first kid. And my kids are only 2 years apart. So being a writer is to me having babies, like young babies that are really high needs. And that was only possible because, like, I quit my job to write and my husband stayed home and did most of the caregiving and still does. So I don't want to present it as like somehow I was working my job and also writing books and also raising young children. I wasn't doing that. But I still had a fairly chaotic life and a fairly chaotic schedule. And so I tried to convince myself, like, you can write in the car seat, you can write early in the morning, you can write late at night, and to maintain kind of a flexibility. I think as I get older, I actually need more sleep and I can't keep writing that way successfully. And so I'm trying to settle into more routines now.
Well, and I've asked this question to all the authors that I've talked to, and everybody has different methods. Everybody has different theories. Like, we have a friend of the podcast who, her one book, she only could get like words in when she was sitting in her car. It didn't matter where she was. Like, she would sit in her garage in her car and write, because that was the only place she had the inspiration. And she's like, I don't know why it's working and what there is special about my car this time, but that's what worked for her.
I had two very young babies, and I wrote that on the dashboard of the minivan. Like, I would go out and sit in the van and type.
I mean, hey, you do what you have to do to get the words in. So for your book, since you don't have any specific rituals or habits, but do you plan out your stories or do you let the words flow?
Yeah, I plan them out pretty in a pretty detailed way. Although I think the planners are just people that like the comfort of thinking that they know where they're going. So I need a pretty good security blanket to go into a book. I spend a long time writing an outline. I have pretty much chapter by chapter before, and usually scene by scene within the chapter before I actually start writing. But the trick is, that's almost always wrong. I'm right about the first scene, I'm right about the last scene, and I have to rewrite the outline like three times in the middle of the book.
I mean, hey, whatever works. So
You might ask, why write a 15,000 word outline? But I have to.
but I mean, if that is your process and your progress, then hey, you do what you have to do. Like, and that's one thing I love about these interviews is every single author has a different process. They have a different way of doing things. Like, some are extremely detailed. I did an interview with an author who, Mariah Enkinman, and she talks about how she's actually adapted her outlining. She writes it, she follows like a screenplay outline, like way of doing things now, and like she's really streamlined that. And then I have some who are like, I know where it starts and where it ends, and the characters tell me where to go from there, and it's just chaos the whole time.
Yeah, I'd have a panic attack. I couldn't do that.
So let's talk The Everlasting. It comes out October 28th, 2025. And so, like, this book, like, there's a lot happening in this book, which that's one of the reasons I asked about the planning, because there's so many like intricate details in the way that the book is created. I was curious if you were a pantser, because I was like, if she's a pantser, that is impressive.
I mean, honestly, I would love to see. I'm sure it's possible. This is not a challenge, but like a pantser doing like time loops in particular, or time travel in general, had like a what I thought was a very detailed table chart of like each time loop and what details changed and what scenes repeated and when the scenes repeated what changed and all this stuff. And I was very proud of it. And then when it went through copy editing, My copy editor, God bless them, made, I think in total it was 30 pages long, a single chart to track every consistency of like where, which side is the scar on, who's wearing what in this timeline, what has changed, is that a legitimate change or an accidental change in this time loop? And it was beautiful. And the amazing thing about that, the most gratifying moment probably in my author in my career, was them being like, yeah, I think like, switch the scar on one side on one loop. Like, you're right, the timelines line up.
Well, and like honestly, the book, like we are in this ever-present looping, and like there is a lot of repetitiveness, but not at the same time. And I honestly, like I don't think I've ever read a book in the way that you've created this story. And you work through like the scholar side, the knight side, but there's parts where like they're telling the story, and so it's like third person, and it's a little chaotic, but not in a bad way.
I mean, thank you. I hope it's not chaotic. Although I did realize at one point that I had done like alternating second person present past tense, and then there's a section of it that's in third person past tense, and then there's little glimpses of first person throughout. And I was like, that's like if you designed a book to get bad reviews on Goodreads, that's the kind of activity you would do. So I don't know, but it felt necessary for this story.
Well, but I think the way the story is structured, because it follows Owen as like he's writing this book, but then also going back in time and like experiencing Una like in his present, but not his present at the same time. And so I think the way that you structured it, like had you not done it in like the varying tenses and varying points of view, I don't think it would have worked as well because of like the back and forth and the repeating and the all of that.
Sorry, you're breaking up a little bit. I don't know if you can you if that's ended in a question, can you repeat it for me?
No, well, I was just saying, like I think that having those tenses in the changes and with the repetition, but the fact that he's telling this story, but it's his story at the same time, I think had you not used the changes in tenses, I don't think it would have worked as well.
Well, I think that's the interesting thing is that I think there's a tendency among readers and writers to think of like third person past as the default and the easiest and the most sort of like it goes down without a reader noticing really what tense and POV it's in. And I've come to think of that almost as like the movie tense, like if you were seeing it on a screen, that's sort of how you would narrate it in your head. And that works for many, many, many books, but it didn't work here because you would become confused if all you knew about what was happening is what you could see on the screen. Like, in order for the emotional part of this to come through, you had to be like way more interior. And I liked it best because it's kind of about storytelling and stuff like that. I liked it best as someone telling you the story in that really intimate tense.
So, what was the inspiration for this world and the way in which the story plays out?
I think the very, very earliest beginning version of this was thinking specifically about like Arthuriana and like the Arthurian myth cycle and all these stories that I'd loved. But I'm not like an Arthurian scholar, and I've read enough versions of those retellings to feel both interested in them and sort of burned out on them. Like the only ones that I think are doing really, really interesting work in that space are people who are so deep in that literature, in the source material, that they are like pulling things out of like original myths. So I think of Nicola Griffith's Spear, which is a novella retelling of Peridor, the Knight of the Round Table. But like she has a doctorate in dead languages. Like she's so immersed in this stuff that and she has gone to archaeological sites. Like she's a very, very intensely dedicated researcher to that. I can't do that. So I didn't want to sort of wade into this thing that isn't mine, but I did want to talk about the part of it that is mine, which is sort of the inherited propaganda that is like third, fourth, fifth hand descended from that, right? Like I didn't grow up reading the original Welsh or something, but I did grow up on Disney's Sword in the Stone and like all the Lady Knight YA books of my youth, and they're all kind of hitting the same cultural notes. And so I wanted to play with that inherited propaganda, but not in that actual exact world.
I mean, I like a good Disney Sword in the Stone.
I know, it's great.
And the worlds, like, they're just the way in which you create it, like, it's real but not real. It's like fantastical but not at the same time. It's like this really nice blend of the two.
I feel like that's my favorite kind of world building, where I'm rarely as sort of entranced by what I think of as like whimsical world building, unless it's in children's fiction, where it's sort of like, ah, oh, look at this magical place, and there's a little a goblin market, or like, I don't know, it's exists to be, I think, kind of in contrast to our world, and your attention is drawn to what's different, and that's really fun in some ways, but it doesn't usually work for me because I feel like you could change everything about our history and the rules, and even add magic. You could add dragons, but you wouldn't fundamentally change like the power hierarchy in society. So I really, really want to hit notes that feel real in that way. Like the world has to play by real world rules, even if you name your countries different things.
I mean, you're not wrong. So, but Una is this character who she's kind of an enigma, like as the story like progresses. And I mean, we learn a lot about her, but then you leave it kind of open-ended at the same time. At least I feel like it, you leave it open-ended at the same time. And then we get to the end where it flips the switch a little bit and you're like, oh, I was not expecting that.
Yeah, I really liked making Una as a character, in part because I have fallen in love with so many lady knights through my reading history. Like, those were the books that I loved so much when I was probably 10 to 15. Any book where a girl had a sword, and I'm thinking of Tamora Pierce, but also Robin McKinley and the Crown Duel books and Sabriel. Just like, I feel like there was this little boom, or maybe it wasn't a real boom. There was a boom in my life of Lady Knight books, and I always loved what they did for a sort of version of gendered heroism that felt inaccessible, even though it was sort of the girl power 90s. It felt like the girl in armor with the sword was doing something different. And so I got to make my own Lady Knight, and I really liked her staying an enigma at the beginning. Like, you're supposed to meet her the same way Owen does, the main character, as a myth first, like as the poster version first, and then slowly she's supposed to become more real.
Well, and I feel like each time loop, like we get almost a different version of her, but not at the same time. Like it's all the same Una, but there's just little pieces that come off differently in each loop. And I just thought that the way you developed her was really interesting.
The theory was, and I don't, again, it's very funny to talk to writers because there's like what you were planning to do versus what you did. And I think there's often a pretty good gap between those two. But the theory was that she should begin as a completely solitary figure, which is necessarily a mythological construct because no one exists in isolation. So she's supposed to, you're supposed to meet her alone, and then her relationships with others, like with the queen or with her rival slash friend Ansel, are supposed to like be added in later loops so that it's clear that even in the most idealized version of her, like she actually wasn't alone. She existed in this network of people.
Well, it almost gives that like Groundhog Day like aspect to it, because like each time like he wakes up, like the day itself is the same, but his actions are different. And like Owen is in he's like Bill Murray in that. And it's not, I'm not comparing it in a bad way because I love me some Groundhog Day,
No, I love time loop stories, and that's like the iconic time loop.
but I think it's that thing. It's because like he goes into it like knowing, I mean, he doesn't know the, I mean, he knows the outcome, but he doesn't know how the outcome's gonna come. And it's just, there's so many evolving elements, and it was a lot, but not at this. Like, this book is involved, people. Involved.
I know. And I'm really curious to see. I feel like this is my least straightforward book in some ways, and so I'm very curious to see, because I feel like each book you write is kind of an ask that you are doing. Often very early on in the first couple of chapters, you are making a big ask of like, are you going to follow me? Are you going to come with me here? Like, stick it out. And this is the by far the biggest ask, because
I take it you've never done a time loop
I've
before.
never done it, and I never will again if
Because
I
I will say
ever try.
this was my first book that I read by you. Giselle had reached out and I was like, oh, this sounds really intriguing. I'm definitely gonna give this a try. And yeah, I but yeah, time loops, like it's complicated. And to
It's
get it
complicated.
right, it's complicated.
Yeah, and I'm never gonna write. I mean, I've asked my
You say
husband to
that
like
now.
stop me if I ever am like, you know what, I could do more time travel. Because this was, you know, like you change something small in one scene just as you're revising, and it ripples in ways that
It's
it
like a
wouldn't normally.
catalyst, yeah.
Yeah.
So, is there something that present author you would tell past author you?
I mean, if there's one thing I have learned from writing time loops, is that you shouldn't make small changes. You don't know what kinds of ripple effects you could have. No, I don't know. I would probably tell her to sleep a little bit more. I think I had a sense early on in my career that, like, if I didn't write the next thing, or if I didn't push in certain ways, that it was all gonna disappear and vanish, which is still true, but the way that I drive myself can't really actually change the precarity of publishing. Like, you just can calm down, live your life, and make your art and see how it shakes out.
Yeah. I mean, that's something. So I just have to make this one comment. I read the acknowledgments like after I finished the book, and you're like, my mom sent me a six pit single space pages describing everything I'd gotten wrong about horses. I cackled a little when I read that.
Love my mom very much, but you do get to see how much, which is feedback I've received. I do sometimes look back at my mom and I'm like, this is not my fault. Like, we bring a level of intensity to what we do that I really appreciate. And I had asked her, in fairness to her, I've been like, I think I literally sent her a document titled, "Okay, Mom, what did I get wrong about horses?"
I mean, if you're gonna have the horses, you need to get
Because
them
she has
right.
trained them her whole life. Like, she's amazing. I'm still gonna probably get emails about a couple of things. I did ignore her advice in several circumstances where she was like, this is the wrong verb. Actually, when they do this, it's called something else. And I was like, I don't know. I think Snakey is right. I just feel proof of.
You're like, I'm going to take artistic liberties and do what I want. So, what is next for Alex E. Harrow?
Oh my goodness, what is next? I have a collection of short stories that is slowly making its way through publishing, that should hopefully, if everything goes well, come out next year.
Oh, fun. I do like myself a short story. Don't know why
Yeah,
I sound
that's
like a
kind of where my
pirate
career
there.
started, actually.
It's been a long couple of weeks.
I hear you.
Well, that's very exciting. You did say that you started doing like the short stories to get like you published originally, so. Kind of going back to the roots.
Yeah, and I've kind of like snuck them in between novels for a couple of years. So, and then I kind of turned around and was like, oh, I have like a dozen. Wow. And then this was a really good excuse to get to write, to actually spend time on new short fiction, which ha is not a financially good use of your time. If you are like a novelist with book deals and deadlines and things like that, you should prioritize that. But I really enjoy them. And so this was like a treat.
So it's almost like word therapy for you.
Yeah, well, and it's so, I'm such a slow writer that the commitment to have an idea and know that I'm going to spend like 2 years on it, probably more if I actually think about all the like research ahead of time and then the editing at the end. But 2 years of just living in that world, I can't do that with every little idea I have. But short fiction is like a little chance.
Like a little taste.
Something at my school.
Okay, I don't.
I think
All
you
right.
froze up again. It was all
Yeah,
jittery.
it was me that time. Well, and on that note, I'm gonna go ahead and say bye to every. Thank you so much for stopping by the podcast and chatting. I appreciated it so much.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a delight.
All right, and until next time, happy reading, everybody.
Find us on Instagram at Buzzing About Romance or on Twitter at Buzzing Romance. If you like the podcast, please leave a review. If you'd like to support us directly, join the Bookcase and Coffee Patreon and receive exclusive content only available to Patreon members. Check out bookcaseandcoffee.com for our on-the-shelf show notes.